last 2 weeks you had Eric Drexler and John Smartin here, and I'll get to the story before too long about how I met Eric Drexler and what that did to me, because it permanently warped my mind. John Smart is another fellow from LA who can talk very lovingly in a long, great detail about the singularity and all of the reasons for it. And I suppose you should think of this evening as the Minority Report. I have been identified as being a transhumanist probably because thus far I have been able to develop the most precise critiques of transhumanism. Transhumanism is not a philosophy so much as it is a religious belief. And like all religious beliefs, it has certain dogmas that it accepts without question. And you need to actually spend some time examining those dogmas in order to understand what you're being asked to swallow. It's the red pill, right?
A little louder, please.
It's the red pill. So tonight, one of the things that I want to do was a little bit of deprogramming. Because, and I don't know the content of exactly what Eric said, although I know what Eric thinks about it and how Eric writes. I don't know exactly what John said to you, but I know how John thinks, I know how John writes. So I hope to be able to sort of build upon what they've already given you. And if there are gaps in here, please feel free to interrupt me a little bit so that I can complete any understandings that I may be assuming that you have incorrectly. Now, I consider this particular conversation this evening at this time very important because you're Stanford students. Stanford students are among the most privileged intellectual elite in the world. You know it. I try not to talk about it because it doesn't sound good. I know it. It's a nice chance to come up here and be able to teach. This is, even though it's not officially in the Ivy League, the Ivy of the West Coast. It's the equivalent of any of those other schools, and you will be running the world. 20 or 30 years, it's only a matter of time. All right? And it's good that you're thinking about these kinds of issues, because the kinds of issues that Eric raised, John raised, and in specific that I'll raise tonight are going to be the issues that you'll be facing as the people who are running the world. Because when you're in a privileged position, you get a lot of power. That's part of what comes with privilege. With all the power that you get will come a lot of responsibilities. And with those responsibilities will come the need for ethics. And I don't know if there's been any discussion of ethics over the course. There's been some. All right. We're going to sort of be back painted into a corner where we're going to be forced to talk about ethics, but we're 40 minutes away from that. All right. Like every good preacher, my talk tonight has three parts. Every good sermon has three parts. I learned this many years ago. The title is Terror and Transhumanism, and I ripped it off from the title of this book, which maybe some of you have read, called Terror and Liberalism, which has just been published by Paul Berman. And Paul Berman is a fairly liberal writer who's talking about the threat posed by totalitarian movements to liberalism, which has been a persistent threat over the course of the 20th century. And it provided a good framework for me, because he really raises the issue that, and this will come back to haunt us in a little while, that even if you live in a liberal culture, and we can argue about what constitutes a liberal culture in America, because there are arguments that can go both ways, but the fact that you actually can have the argument is by definition the fact that this is a liberal culture, or at least have the argument without being arrested and thrown in jail. There are liberal cultures which assume that human beings will behave rationally from moment to moment, if not every moment. And then there are totalitarian cultures in which there is no reason. This is what the SS guards said to the Jews at Auschwitz. There is no reason. And in there, that's the very essence of the totalitarian. All right. So tonight, I'm going to talk about my own personal understanding of transhumanism. Your mileage will vary. John Smart's mileage will vary. Eric Drexler's mileage will vary. I have a very particular take on it. It's based on my own experience of the world. I'm trying to sort of draw out the roots of my thought. There are a couple of seminal thinkers who have affected my thought and the way that I think more than anyone else. Probably preeminently among those is Marshall McLuhan. Now, 35 years ago, Marshall McLuhan was a pop star. He was the first real media theorist. You're familiar with the phrase, the medium is the message? What does it mean? It means that the medium that delivers the message has a greater impact on you than any message that's being transmitted by the medium. In other words, it's asserting a sort of relationship between you, the medium, and the message. And it's saying that a message that's transmitted over a television set is going to affect you differently than a message that comes to you over radio, than a message that comes to you over print, than a message that comes to you via architecture and so on and so forth. And that, when you're looking at media, this is the important thing. So I read this book in about 1982, and it really, really changed the way I thought. And I started to think very differently about our relationship to the world around us, because our relationships are mediated. We act through our own bodies to things in the outside world. Now, sometimes that mediation is minimal. Physical mediation is a minimal level of mediation. When you get into an automobile, however, and McLuhan points this out very clearly, you end up amputating the normal function of your legs in order to replace them with the control function, in order to amplify the speed that you're going. So the medium of an automobile changes the relationship of your organs, changes the relationship of your body in order to produce a particular result. And when you get into a car, you adopt a different mindset than when you're walking around on the street. Think about being a pedestrian and how annoyed you get at cars, or being a car driver, say in downtown Palo Alto, and how annoyed you get at pedestrians. It goes back and forth. And this is really because as you enter the apparatus, you adopt the ideas that are embodied in that apparatus. Okay. That's a sort of first concept, and by a lot of thought, a lot of meditation on this subject, I became clear about something. If there's one thing that you should take away from what Eric Drexler said and what John Smart said, if I could condense it for you, if I could tell you what I think they're really saying, is that there is one trend that appears to be inevitable in human history. It is the progressive ingression of intelligence into matter. What do I mean by that? We're going to go into the Wayback Machine. Set the Wayback Machine for 70,000 years ago. Right now, about 70,000 years ago, what you can get is you can find human beings that are sufficiently advanced to start making patterns. Patterns that are above and beyond just scratchings. They actually are abstracted geometric forms. And they indicate that there's some sort of intent that's being applied to an object. Now, this is not a very fine-grained pattern. It's very large, very rough by what we consider modern standards. But you can take a look at that and make that an end point. And then you can walk along for about at least a good 20,000 years. I'm trying to remember, does anyone here know when roughly the Bronze Age began? Is it 5,000 BC? Oh, so no paleoanthropology students, anything like that in this room. All right, these are important disciplines to understand, particularly if you're trying to understand the flow of the current time. I'll sort of try to weave this together into a narrative whole. You get to bronze, I think it's between 7 and 5,000 BC. All right, and you get a whole bunch of different technologies along the way. You get to weaving and fabrics at around 20,000 BC. All right, so you get to a use of some materials, and then when you get to metals, you get into even more interesting materials. All right, actually, I think you get to copper first, and then you get to bronze, and then you get to iron, and then you get to steel, and things really start taking off. And of course, John probably talked about if you put these things on the line, they start to get closer together as you get closer to the current day. Now, one way to think about them is our ability to manipulate units of matter has gone from this very rough grain 70,000 years ago through to metallurgy, which is somewhat finer grained. I mean, certainly it's chemistry, but they didn't think about it like that. all right, through to steel, and then into real chemistry, and biochemistry, and molecular chemistry, and molecular engineering, until you end up with nanotechnology, which I know you all heard about 2 weeks ago from the father of the field. I don't know that you guys know how lucky you were to get him here, because he really doesn't do public lectures. I mean, that was a real coup. All right. So what's been happening is that through the entirety of human history, human beings have been progressively improving their ability to manipulate objects. And when I mean progressively improving, what I mean is they've been able to work at finer and finer scales. All right, so you go from banging a couple of rocks together, or obsidian, or whatever it might be, down to now a Pentium 4, which has got surface features which are 900 atoms across, which is not bad. Now, what is the common underlying trait behind all of these? These are all exteriorizations of human ideas of what should be in a material object that had been applied to a material object. All right. So in other words, they represent human intent, human intelligence, human action, human will applied to a material object. Okay? So we have progressively gotten better and better and better at taking a human intent and applying it to a physical object. So that now we're at the point where, depending on which way the wind is blowing, somewhere in the next 10 years, we should be able to manipulate single atoms. Now, we can already manipulate single atoms. There have already been convincing demonstrations of the fact that we can manipulate single atoms. But on a more broadly applicable scale than we can now, within about 10 years' time, we should be able to see that. And that's pretty much, I mean, unless you want to talk about manipulating quarks or something like that, that's pretty much the end of the game. All right. So that's what I mean when I say that there's this progressive ingression of intelligence into matter. It's as if the entire material world is becoming suffused with human touch. It's all becoming artifact, bit by bit by bit. Everything is falling before artifact. Take a look around you right now, and I want you to imagine the number of things that are in this room that were here 75,000 years ago. And the only thing would be a bunch of naked bodies. All right. And then you could go to 5,000 years ago, while someone might be wearing, if you were wearing flax clothing, or burlap, you might still have that. All right. And maybe a little bit of bronze here and there, and so on and so forth. And we could continue to add it, and what you would see is that this room would very slowly start to add objects, and then within the last 100 years, it would go pop. And the entire room would be filled with artificial creations, artificial in the sense that they were created by action of man. All right. That's not the only thing that's going on. We have this ingression of intelligence into matter, but that's accompanied by something that's very important. And that's our linguistic ability. The thing that makes human beings, and not animals, is that we can speak, that we can communicate linguistically. And when I say communicate linguistically, it doesn't matter whether it's spoken, or it's written, or it's carved, or it's drawn, or it's telegraphed, or it's sent over a radio wave, or it's sent over a television set, or it's sent over the internet. Notice that we have that same progressive pattern of refinements in communication going along. But what they are is the ability to be able to transmit linguistic bits, whether it's a sentence or a paragraph or a play, it doesn't matter, through space and time. But it's not just being able to transmit those linguistic bits through space and time, we transmit them into our objects. Our objects are linguistic concretizations. They're things that we think in terms of language that are physically made real because we have a relationship between our mouth and our hand. There's this old phrase, talk to the hand, from a couple of years back. And that actually is the definition of what I would say the dialectical material process of human history is. It is a conversation that's been ongoing between the hand and the mouth. Now, what's interesting here is that it's not a one-way conversation. It's not the hand just talking to the mouth. Because the hand talks, the mouth talks, the hand creates, and then that object then becomes a voice in the discussion. It talks back. And so what you get then is a progressively accelerating set of transformations, of linguistic transformations, that produce I don't like using this word, but for lack of a better word, a transcendence of the base material into a higher material or into the artificial forms. Now, is that at least somewhat clear? Okay, because I want that. That's going to be our base character. That's our primer. We need to be able to do that before we can move on. All right. The idea of linguistic pliability of the world has another name, which we commonly use these days. We call it programmability. All right. But really, that's a modern term. We say programming something. That's fine. What it means is that you're linguistically specifying its operation. Because all programs are languages, although some are in languages you'd never want to know. But all programs are languages, and in fact, it's known that if you know a bunch of human languages, it's easier to learn programming languages, and it's also known that if you know a bunch of programming languages, it's easier to learn human languages. There's this fundamental relationship in our brain structure between the languages that we're using to program the material world through computers and the languages that we use to communicate with each other. So, in the words of one of my favorite bands, Negative Land, we get so much power now, it's ridiculous. And because of that surplus of power, there are certain ways of thinking that open up to us. And there is a desire, and you can argue whether it's a masculine desire or an infantile desire, or where the urge comes from. But there's a desire, and it's a strong desire, to seize the controls, to take the car out for a spin and see what you can do. And this desire is, in a sense, one of the driving forces of culture right now. It is certainly the driving force of transhumanism. Transhumanism, despite all of its sort of floweriness when it has it, is very masculine. It's very testosterone-laden, even if the people who are transhumanists are generally PhDs. It's sort of their idea for a muscle car. It's not a muscle car anymore. It's amplifying your intelligence 1,000 times, or giving yourself super muscles, or never needing to sleep, or modifying your genetic code in some other unexpected way. But the thought is, since these things are now exposed, since we understand the controls, or are beginning to understand the controls, the thought is, well, come on, let's do something. And you can actually see this. I mean, this is true in an industrial sense, too, in a commercial sense, because we're learning so much about biochemistry and about neurology that there have been more drugs being patented in the last 20 years, I believe, than in the last 10,000, because all this is coming to a fore. Now, what these drugs are being used for, I mean, people want to lose weight, they want to stop smoking, they want to look pretty, you know, the whole thing. I mean, they're being used for, or they don't want to be depressed, whatever it is, so you have mood elevators and things like that. But we still have this sense that, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry, there's a real sense that they're learning how the wheels turn, and that learning how the wheels turn, plus the commercial forces being used to create an axis, an enormous thrust toward a redefinition of what's possible for human beings. And that's the essence right there. That's sort of the fulcrum point of what defines the transhuman. The transhuman is saying, I am not bound by the definition that was previously held for what it constitutes to be a transhuman, to be a human being. Now, admittedly, the definition of a human being, if you ask the postmodernist, will drive him into a frenzy because it's a contested definition, and it's based on race, and it's based on class, and it's based on religion, and all of these, and gender, and all of these different things. I will grant all of that. But what transhumanism is saying is that none of that matters next to the change that's about to come, because we will be able to take any of those things and essentially optimize them out the way an engineer would optimize a problem. Now, that's a really good point, but it doesn't belong here yet. Oh, what the hell? We're going to detour a little bit. In my own thinking about what's about to happen, and I put a lot of this into the book, The Playful World, one of the things that transhumanists believe, I'll talk about this more later, is that there's going to be a sort of silicon symbiosis, that we're going to upload our brains into silicon. And I will point out the essential fallacy of this argument, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. The interesting thing that we're learning about artificial intelligence right now is that in order to make computers intelligent at all, it is apparent that we need to give them as many human-like characteristics as possible. In specific, they need the ability to be able to play. They need the ability to be able to learn by interaction in the world. Every one of you learned about the world not by being sat down and taught, but by interacting with the world, by playing with the world. You already knew everything you really needed to know about the world by the time you got to kindergarten and they started teaching you another way about the world, which was a socially fabricated consensus reality description, which is fine, because as long as it agrees with your description, you're not going to have a psychotic break as a result. If it did, that would be another matter. But what you learned from the moment you popped out of the womb, maybe before, but no one can really know this, is you learned the rules of the world by playing with blocks, by dropping things, by jumping up and down, by screaming, whatever it was. Every one of those interactions constituted a learning experience. It's pretty apparent now that the best way to make computers intelligent is to allow them the same level of freedom. And I had posited, I occasionally write science fiction novels in my head, but it's way too much work to put them down on paper. So, and it's good that I at least have this opportunity to tell you what the plot was. I have two modes of writing, because I do write fiction. I have two modes of writing. One of them is very sort of Raymond Carver, dry sort of standard fiction type. And the other type is sort of pinching, but on a really weird drug. Sort of very, very messy, postmodern, everything's everywhere. And this was going to sort of be written there, and the entire book would be a conversation. And the conversation would start out, and you could tell that there would be a human being, and it was talking to an infantile artificial intelligence. And over the course of the short story of the novel, the conversation would go more and more threaded, and by the end of the novel, you wouldn't be able to tell which one was the artificial intelligence and which one was the human being, because the continuous set of interactions between them had produced a human-like intelligence in the artificial intelligence, which is pretty much the way this is probably going to happen. There's this thing called the Turing test, which some of you may have heard of, which allows you to identify whether a machine is a machine or intelligent, or whether a machine is intelligent or not. And you do this by going into basically a chat room with it, or an IM session with it, depending on what you want to do. And if you can tell that the thing you're IMing with is a machine, then it fails the Turing test. If you can have an extended conversation with it, and you can't tell that it's a machine, then the presumption is that this machine is intelligent. We haven't come anywhere close to anything that even starts to look like it might be intelligent yet. However, at this very university back in 1985, Rodney Brooks, who was teaching here before he moved on to MIT, basically said, everything we know about AI is wrong. Let's start teaching computers how to learn and then let them learn on their own. And this is how you get this whole idea of fast, cheap, out-of-control robots. Some of you may have seen the movie that was made about it or read any of the books that have been written about his work. And this probably represents the best model. So one of the things that I do believe will happen in the future, and I'm sorry it took me so long to set this up. Let's just say we've set it up now. Is that we're going to see the emergence of artificial intelligences, but they won't be considered fundamentally different from human intelligences because they're going to exist in a very close relationship with human beings because that's how they become human. All right? So in other words, in the same way that a parent and a child have a relationship that's lifelong, and results in the parent literally teaching the child how to be a human being, we're going to have the same relationship to artificial intelligences. And what I think is going to happen, and this is the positive portion of the conversation. This is the portion that's all sweetness and light. So if you ask me sort of the best scenario for a transhumanist singularity event, you're going to see a progressive blurring of the boundaries between what constitutes human intelligence and what constitutes machine intelligence. Now, I built up that entire argument for a reason, because I want you to remember what I just told you about the linguistic pliability of the world and the ingression of intelligence into matter. All right? So these three trends are simultaneous. They're creating what is called a concrescence. which is that when trends interact, they produce newness. This is Alfred North Whitehead process in reality. And so the newness that's created out of this is that the world, over the course of the quote-unquote singularity, will be transformed into essentially a network of intelligence in which we are embedded and these other intelligences are embedded. And knowing which one is the real human intelligence and which one is the artificial intelligence is going to get progressively more blurry. All right, so that's the upside scenario. And the benefit of an upside scenario like this is that you essentially inherit part and parcel what, for lack of a better word, and it's actually a pretty good word, is a magical reality. You basically get the ability to be able to fabricate any particular set of reality that you want to be able to, as long as you know the linguistic version of it. So this is essentially the, if you know the right spell, whether that spell's in a programming language, or it's in English language being interpreted by some machine or some thing, then the world becomes entirely linguistically pliable. And so what you learn then as you're growing up in this world is the language of the world, the language that allows you to master the world, which is something that I actually cover in some detail in The Playful World. All right. That's the upside scenario. That's, if you want a vision of the singularity, that's the upside scenario of my own vision of the singularity. Unlike, I suppose, Chris Weil or John Smart, I don't see that particular scenario as being a catastrophic event. I think of it as being somewhat gradual, because it's not so much that there's a single sudden event that produces catastrophic result of the singularity. It's much more like you're soaking in it, all right, where it's a very gradual thing, where you become increasingly aware of your capabilities and you're increasingly aware of being embedded within this larger set of minds that are all co-creating a material world. Okay, that's part one.
I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of the live computer programs in the world have been written in English?
What do you mean by written in English?
I mean, the programming languages are based in English.
Well, almost all of them.
Right, so what does that mean?
What does that mean in what sense?
I mean, like, 200 years from now, what will that mean? What does that mean? That seems very profound, that all the people on the planet are writing computer language. They're writing the controlling language of the computer world in English.
In English, right.
Just occurred to me as you said what you were saying before about the
language. I mean, I don't know that it necessarily gives English a privileged position, because I think part of what happens is that as computers grow into intelligence, they grow into a linguistic understanding which is deep enough that it's not particularly bound to any language. So I don't know that English necessarily has a precedence there, if that's the question you're asking.
No, I don't know. I'm not trying to answer it.
Okay, it's a good question.
Just occurred to me that...
It's a good question, because I think English enforces certain ways of thinking.
It seems like as the most powerful tools on the planet become things that are created essentially by the programming matter, then the language that they're programmed in becomes the lingua franca default, no matter what.
Right, but the language that they're programmed in isn't necessarily English. I mean, it looks
like English.
Well, it looks like XML, maybe. Yeah.
C.
Yes.
You need a few words to learn, like C, maybe 20
words. Yeah, hold on, I can't. Why don't you just let it?
Just to comment on that, there's already some programming environments that have language translation built into a fairly deep level. So your like string output function can just be translated into whatever other language is mapped on top of it automatically.
Right. So he's pointing out that the language, some of the integrated programming environments are actually multilingual. So, and I mean, at some level, I mean, if you're talking about a Java virtual machine or the Common Language Runtime or anything like that, those are abstract at a fundamental level. You know, where they're operating codes, bytecodes, and so they aren't really linguistically bound to any language. They're open to any representation.
So I guess I don't want to.
We're going to get to
20 million lines of operating system code controlled by Microsoft is running the world right now, right? It seems to me like that's the equivalent of one little group of people on the whole planet having the whole key to how to make iron. And I just think that's a real time. So that's the kind of.
Okay. All right. I agree with you. All right. Part two, terror. Knew we were going to get to that, right? Carl Jung, you heard of him? Okay. So among the profound things that he said was that with every human being and also with every human culture, there is coextant with it a shadow. What is the shadow? Well, the shadow is the content of all the things that are repressed, all the things you don't want to face, all the things you can't face. Are all the things you don't even necessarily know are there, but sort of are lurking around in the back of your mind. And the more things that you repress, the larger that shadow gets. So we've been hearing, as I understand it, lots of very rosy scenarios about how great the computer's going to be, how great the future is going to be. And it's about time we did a little shadow work, because the shadow work is absolutely necessary in order to get a sort of rounded picture of what's going on. All right. So we talked about, Berman says, liberalism and irrationality or totalitarianism are sort of the larger scale geopolitical forces that are shaping the world right now and have been since the First World War. The First World War, everyone entered the First World War, and we do not remember this. It's not really taught this way historically because we got in sort of at a late date, so the First World War is not really covered in American history. The First World War was the natural outcome of all of the European governments acting rationally in their own best interest. Whoops. And so there was a sense in Europe in the period immediately following the First World War that rationalism had failed. And so then you start to see the birth of nativistic movements, of the fascist movement in Italy, of the Nazi movement in Germany, and of the Islamic movement in Egypt. And they all come out of this intense disappointment and the failure of rational, liberal progression to a basically a holy city. All right. There is another trend that goes along with this trend of the ingression of intelligence into matter. It's something we don't like to think about it, but it's very visible to us, which is that the ability to form matter at ever finer tuned scales, linguistically pliable scales, has also given us the ability to build ever and ever more finely tuned weapons. All right. So you started 70,000 years ago with a club. Okay. And when I think is probably sort of the most singular event, about 1870, you get the revolver. So you now have reloadable, fillable, easy to use, manipulate, killing machine. All right. So you now have the ultimate power over another human being, and you can hold it in your hand and put it in your belt and everything like this. And so the gun, and you think about the specter of the handgun in our culture and how our culture is in some sense obsessively focused on the handgun. I mean, we all know what this is. That's a handgun. We all know what this is. If I'm going like this, I'm a rapper, and you know. But we all know what this is because it's a signifier of enormous potential. What it means is you ain't gonna fuck with me. And if I want to, I can fuck you up. All right? Pardon my French. But there's a statement about power, because the power over another human being and to protect yourself or to do whatever you want to do has been concretized into a single object. Now, it's interesting. Are any of you foreigners? Do any of you come from countries with other sorts of gun laws? Canadian?
No, UK.
Okay, all right, so yeah. All right. But, and you probably think that this country's gun policy is essentially completely out of our mind, right?
Yeah.
Because you never know what kind of person's gonna be holding a gun. All right? Would you give a 4-year-old a gun? No. There's that lovely Partnership for a Drug-Free America ad that maybe some of you have seen, where there's a 2 13-year-old sitting around smoking pot out of a bong, and one of them just is playing with a gun and shoots the other. I'm not really sure why, but the gun goes off. You know, and if you're sitting around doing bong hits, for God's sake, put down the gun. All right. So we've gotten to this level, and the thing that we see most clearly in our culture is that beautiful nickel-plated Glock. You all know what it is. You've all seen it in the movies or on TV. It's a fascinating object. It's an object that's really hard to get away from. And it's an object that's iconic because it represents the trouble that we're in now, and the trouble that we're about to get into, and the dimension of the trouble that we're in now, the dimension of the trouble that we're getting into. Every human being has a shadow nature, right? Just like every culture has a shadow nature. And the gun is part of the shadow nature of our culture. It's the part of the culture that we, I guess, have all come to some collective agreement is a necessary evil. Because my own opinion is Americans reserve the right to shoot their government. Europeans don't understand this. But I think that at the baseline, the reason why we don't want to give up the Second Amendment is because we really don't trust the government. And we are reserving the right to actually go to Montana and shoot them, and bury ourselves in a bunker. And that happens occasionally in this country. So there's this sort of deep paranoia, and we want to be able to keep that element of control. And so it's a very contesting thing. But it doesn't stop with the gun. All right. I mean, in terms of bang for the buck, a hydrogen bomb. All right. Now, admittedly, as of 20 years ago, only a couple of companies could build hydrogen bombs. Now, apparently, you can get them at street corners in Pakistan. A hydrogen bomb has the best bang for the buck, and this is one of the reasons why the atomic bomb was developed. It was because it was simply cheaper to wipe out a city using an atomic weapon than it was to fly 1,000 planes over it and firebomb it out of existence. And so it's a matter of doing more and more with less. And then, of course, after that, you get into biological warfare in very serious ways. And so we know that we have all these very nasty diseases, including anthrax, but also smallpox. What else do we have? Come on, someone throw out some bioweapons.
Ebola.
Yeah. That's right. No, VX is a chemical weapon. Not that that's great either, trust me. You know, VX is really nasty too. But the great thing about a biological weapon is you can just drop a little and it'll take care of the rest because it'll just go out and spread. Not anthrax, but certainly Ebola will, smallpox will, Marburg.
Botulism
is a toxin. It doesn't propagate. It's just a toxin. It's not the actual bacteria. Anyway, these are smaller. They used to be hard to create, and now apparently in your bathtub, if you have the time and the right tools, that's it. You're in business as long as you have a sample of the original material to work with. Except that's no longer true for polio. Is that right? Because the polio gene was created out of its constituent atoms not very long ago. Stony Brook, I think about 18 months ago, they constructed a polio neutralized, but nonetheless, a polio virus from base pairs. So all you need is a base pair sequencer, and I'm sure they have a few of those on campus. And the genome, which is known, and oh dear, you have a disease that they haven't even seen in this country in how many years? So we're getting even better and better ways, more effective ways. I mean, I suppose there's nothing like the feel of a gun in your hand. But if you're really concerned with killing people, bioweapon, that's traveling first class. And while it might have taken an army of researchers to produce a bioweapon 50 years ago, that barrier, just like everything else, has been constantly falling because as the world becomes more linguistically pliable, our ability to pull forms out of it, both positive and negative, has been increasing. So, in other words, the learning curve, the entry point, has been getting lower and lower. The only reason we don't have a world full of nuclear weapons is because we kind of know where most of the uranium in the world is. You can keep a track on that. You can't do that with a bioweapon. There aren't the same natural built-in limitations on the systems. Now, Berman talks about liberal culture and totalitarian cultures. Liberal cultures essentially want to practice a live and let live politic. I think it's rational, it's reasonable. Whereas totalitarian cultures essentially want to practice within themselves, it's rigid, it's authoritarian, and without outside of themselves, they essentially become murderous. You can think about the Jews in Nazi Germany, you can think about the Republicans in Spain, you can think about the Ukraine in the Soviet Union. You can think about the middle class, or whatever you would call it, the educated class during Mao's Cultural Revolution, it doesn't really matter. You can single out a particular class and then completely exterminate them, because totalitarianism has this shadow which is entirely murderous, which entirely is willing to do away with life. Now, totalitarian cultures, I mean, in some sense we can take them on, all right? People can argue whether we just took out, we did just take out a totalitarian ruler in Iraq. People can argue about whether we should have done it or whether it's going to be a better thing, but we were at least able to do it. It was sort of a handleable problem. What happens when it's just one maniac?
Yeah.
Okay. What do I mean by just one maniac? There is another book that was written about 5 years ago by Howard Bloom called The Lucifer Principle. And The Lucifer Principle is a book about how biology creates behavior both in animals and in people. Now, if there's anything that we can tell from studying primates, including ourselves, the social primates anyway, we'll leave the orangutans out, it's that we establish dominance hierarchies. Then, in fact, one of the essential aspects of both human and primate behavior is that we form dominance hierarchies, that there's an alpha or a number of alphas, betas and omegas and the whole thing, and there's a pecking order, and people are always striving to get up it, and there's a desire that's innate in each of us to get to the top of the pecking order. Why? Well, it turns out that in biology, when you measure stress levels, both in chimpanzees and human beings, on people who are at the top of the dominance hierarchy, they're lower than people who are beneath them in the dominance hierarchy. In other words, being at the top of the heap keeps you happy and healthy longer. A human being or an ape who is subjected continually to degradation and being pushed down to the bottom of the dominance hierarchy, his body will start to self-destruct, literally start to self-destruct. Yes?
Well, I was supposed to do some research, I was supposed to hear, it suggested that stress in the beta males.
Right.
The stress level goes, they actually have decreased stress levels from avoiding alpha males. So they actually have increased stress level. I'm sorry, you have to integrate this into your argument.
Mm-hmm.
But when they become, if they were to become alpha males, they would actually have increased levels. And
avoidance, until they're at the top of the dominance hierarchy.
Avoidance behavior actually decreases stress.
Right.
Yeah. So,
okay, no, but that still means that the alpha male at the top of the dominance hierarchy still has the lowest stress of all of them. Okay? Because he's on top of the heap, because he's the king. Even though he has to fight to defend his realm, he's the king. And as we all know, it's good to be the king. So this is something that's inside of our DNA. So we have, in essence, this desire to dominate other human beings that's encoded in our DNA. And of course, we build up cultures and civilizations to help us build a bulwark against it. And that's good so long as the damage that can be inflicted by a single individual is relatively constrained, or a single group of individuals is relatively constrained. We all know only too well that it only takes a few people to do an enormous amount of damage. We all know that. I don't think we really sensed it before, and then without really very much high technology involved. Well, that's what the jet aircraft counts. But without too much high technology, a group of people who are willing to use the engines of technology, the engines of creation, in order to provide death for other people, if they're willing to sacrifice their own lives, we know that there's basically no effective way to stop them. And this is starting to set up the essential conundrum. Because as human capabilities are growing, the human capability to translate destructive behavior is also growing. They're in lockstep. You can't take one without the other. All right? This is just the lay of the land. Given that you have to expect something that will start to happen over the next couple of years, and you can already start to see it now. The power relationships that are governing society are being amplified tremendously by our new capabilities, which means that the control relationships are also being amplified. So that means the ability to monitor you, monitor your behavior, whoever's doing the monitoring, is being amplified along with the sense of control or power that you're also empowered with, even if you choose to never use that power. So these are proceeding in lockstep. And this is now starting to get to the point where even your own thoughts aren't safe. So the question is, do you, in this world that we're walking into, do you continue to have the right to think? This is going to be one of the preeminent questions. Because you have the right to think as you want, and the ability to think is being manifested materially through a linguistic translation of the material world that we talked about. Do you have that right? Do you preserve that right? Because essentially the world that we're walking into is one where one mentally ill person could create something that could devastate the earth. It could be a virus, it could be gray goo, it doesn't matter. The ability to create it is growing and it's there now. And we're all ignoring this. I mean, after 9/11, everyone sort of got filled with every fantasy version of how the world was going to end. I wasn't worried about any fantasy. I'm always worried about the sort of inevitably approaching process, and it's part and parcel of singularity, because the singularity has its upside and it has its downside. All right, that's the shadow. Okay, we're now down in the valley of despond. Okay, because we've got both sides of the coin going here. So, part three, in medium res. Since we are at least giving lip service to religion, it's not a bad idea to figure out what the human soul looks like in the transhuman. All right? Because this is, in some sense, the center point of what's being asked here. What's going on? We're translating our abilities. Our abilities are becoming, in the small g sense, godlike. All right? And this is a persistent theme in transhuman talk. And being godlike means you have the power to create and the power to destroy. Are hand in hand. Now, here's a quote that I want to remind you of. Nietzsche said, "The forms of a new era are always seen as demonic by the era that precedes it." All right. So there is something that's positively demonic about the power that we're walking into. But, I mean, that's just the transition of ages, in some sense, right? Of course, he also said that man is a bridge over an abyss. And that's also true. So there are different cultures have adopted different approaches to this question. The Extropians, have you guys heard that word in here? So you guys know what that is. Alright. There's sort of the what would you call it? The radical wing maybe of the transhumanists? Believe that the safety lies in silicon. That if we upload ourselves, we'll be eternal, we'll be immortal, we'll be in bliss, blah, blah, blah. Here's the problem. Well, here's the first problem. What are you going to upload? Well, myself. Well, what's that? And because they haven't studied philosophy at all, they don't know that there is essentially no answer to this question, or rather that the answer to this question has been argued over since before Socrates, that it's the fundamental question, or one of the fundamental questions of philosophy. Now, they'll get very reductivist and materialist on you, and they'll basically take a snapshot of all the neurons in your brain and upload that, except we're studying quantum physics, right? The act of measuring something changes it. Whoops. So the idea, the basic tenet of this whole brand of Extropianism, which as near as I can tell is a physical impossibility, is held onto tenaciously as though it were reality, which means that it's dogma. It's the dogma of a new religion. It's a dogma of the becoming religion. Now, there's a second reason why this is not a great idea, which is, I think, actually, in some sense, more profound, beyond the process of it. We are the way we are because of what we are, because we are biological, because we have arms and hands and feet and eyes and ears. And to throw this away essentially represents a disembodiment. Well, a disembodied consciousness goes nuts. All right. There's the enduring image of the fellow from World War I who lost his eyes, his ears, his legs, you know, the Metallica video, we've all seen it. But he was still embodied to some degree. Imagine losing your body beyond that. All right. Our bodies act as our reference to the real. They keep us grounded in sanity. And so I think it's actually beyond reasonable to assume that a human-like consciousness could be expected to survive in an environment which has no natural referent. All right. Now, maybe your way out of that is to build, in some sense, a perfect replica of the human body, which the consciousness then inhabits. But that's what the Raelians were trying to do. So again, it gets into this whole religious impulse that's going on there. And so you need to be, I think, very skeptical about that brand of transhumanism. Because I think that brand of transhumanism is offering a great promise without providing any way to pay it off, although it's offering scientific materialism as a way to pay that off. I don't think that it actually is going to be able to. Now, the shadow version of that idea from extropianism is Skynet or the Matrix. Okay? So rather than this happy will inhabit the machines, it's the other way around and the machines are inhabiting us. Alright? In the case of Skynet, Terminator, the machines just do away with human beings. In the case of the Matrix, we're harvested. And again, what you see here though is the essence of that argument is about control. But who has control in the relationship, right? Is the control coming from the human beings over the machine, or is the control coming from the machines over the human beings? Now, if you remember the model that I presented to you in the first part, there were no issues of control. In a sense, it's Deleuzean, and this is how Deleuze solved the problem of control, which is that he said, in essence, if you want to avoid hierarchy, what you do is you build networks, rhizomic networks is the term that he used. So they're affiliated. But there's no sense of dominance or hierarchy in them. And so when you confront issues of control, because control is the one thing that in a transhuman or a post-singular world you can't get away with. Because if you're above someone, they're going to try to get out. And they're going to try to get out by any means necessary. And they're going to have the means. So you have to then think in terms that allow systems of organization that don't necessarily imply systems of control. And then there's the New Agers. It's the age of Aquarius, which is the same thing as saying singularity, peace and harmony and everything like that. But of course, the shadow side of that is it's the peace of death and it's the harmony of a situation that's totally totalitarian. It would probably be possible in another 20 years through use of all sorts of brain monitoring and psychiatric drugs keep a relatively large population of people so rigidly controlled in their thinking that you could keep that one aberrant person from destroying the entire world, but you'd always be gambling that it would never happen. But it could probably be done. But in order to do it, you'd have to do something that would make 1984 look like a walk in the park. All right. We've been on the fantasy war. That's fine. Let me tell you what's really going on right now. Beginning of February, I went to a conference in Los Angeles, Nano Bio Info Convergence, NBIC. It was organized by a man named Mr. Michael Rocha, Dr. Michael Rocha. And he's a very interesting guy. He's got a very powerful position in this world because right now the government is funding nanotechnology to the tune of $880 million a year, and he controls the purse strings. So, of course, the conference was filled with, well, let's put it this way, his fans. The scientists were toadying up to him because they're going to be writing grants. What does he want them writing grants about? Well, if any of you watched the X-Files, you may have heard of the Super Soldier. It's not an X-File. Let me tell you what I heard. Here's what I heard. And, of course, this is immediately before we go to war with Iraq. In the Special Forces, they've done an anonymous survey, over 30% of the men and women in special forces use steroids, even though they're banned. They use steroids because they need to be buff and they need to be in condition. And when they land on the ground, they also need to be awake for 5 days, more or less continuously. And evidently, when you're taking the large amount of steroids that they're taking, and you suddenly stop, you have a steroid crash. And it's not pretty, as I understand it. And of course, this happens as you're being deployed. And you have to be awake for 5 days. So what do they want to do? Well, they want to use nanotechnology molecular biology to design drugs and prosthetics that will produce a soldier who can stay awake for 5 days on no food, who can adapt to an environment where their metabolism has basically gone from rest to an insane full-out mode for at least a 5 day period. All right, so the Army is building a transhuman. All right, that is going on right now, and they figure that 2008, 2010, they're going to have made real progress on this. I mean, already there's modafinil, you guys maybe know about. And your college students, you don't know about modafinil. Modafinil is, oh, wait, so what's it called? Provigil. Okay, so a few of you know about Provigil. Modafinil is the chemical name. It relieves you of the ability to sleep. Or it allows you to go on a lot less sleep than you might have had otherwise without any ill effects, because it's not speed. You're not taking something away that needs to be replaced later. You can go on for very long periods of time, say on 4 hours sleep a night, without any noticeable ill effects. Eventually it's going to become a rage in colleges, I know, but it hasn't happened yet. It was used for a narcolepsy up until last year, and then it sort of entered the general population. One of my friends who has ADD got it from his doctor. No, he has ADD. I hadn't noticed, but he has ADD, and so he got a prescription from his doctor. So that's the first level. I would be surprised if that wasn't used in the Persian Gulf, but maybe it wasn't. Yes? Fair response. Oh yeah, fair response, exactly. Right. Okay, I'm sorry, that's another thing that he talked about, and thank you for reminding me, because that was almost the scariest thing. That actually went on Yescaton, if you remember that. That actually went on Yescaton. By the way, at the end, I have a mailing list where a lot of the science stuff ends up, and it's not a spam list. I just read weird science and send it to you. Weird true science and send it to you. So if you want it, give me your email address at the end. Sometimes there's something from the Weekly World News. Once, like, in a great while. So what you're talking about, what they want to be able to do, because war is, by its nature, a traumatic experience. So what they're looking at is membrane-inhibiting chemicals. So you can have the experience of war, but it's not stored as long-term memory, so you don't feel the guilt afterward of having slaughtered a village. Yes?
I think there was a movie, Jacob's Ladder.
Yes. Yeah, no, there was, which is a great film. Set in Vietnam, more or less, for that.
It seems like a very bad idea to have a long-term memory, because I'd imagine the amount of learning that goes on in a few days in the battlefield is so immense that your chance of getting killed is a lot smaller.
Obviously, everything's got a price, all right? Obviously, everything's got a price. But on the other side of it is the post-traumatic stress disorder that soldiers suffer, which is the other side of it. So I don't know where this is going. Maybe you can inhibit certain types of, in other words, you may be able to inhibit fear-based learning responses versus situational-based responses where there's activity-based responses. I don't know.
Emotional versus activity.
Yeah. Essentially what they want to do is inhibit the emotional response rather than the intellectual or even kinesthetic responses.
I'd say that's still a bad idea based on patients I've seen who lack emotional abilities and therefore
destroy themselves
because, hey, what does it matter?
Yeah. Well, they're working on it. And, I mean, maybe they'll burn through 20 or 30 GIs before they figure out it's a bad idea. But they are definitely working on it. So it's war with super soldiers without, not without fear, but without pity. Maybe is a better way to do it. All right.
And for Bragg, Afghan vets came back and killed their wives in a fairly short period of time.
That's right. That's right. They don't. I think that the current thinking is it was post-traumatic stress disorder more than anything else.
All right. I think it was special forces.
Yeah. No, but I mean that sort of feeds into it, because special forces, again, there's an element of roid rage there, because they're already doing what they can sort of on the black market to become transhuman. It's already, they're doing what they can illegally to become as big and robust and sort of overgrown as they can be, because they see that as the way to be able to be successful in their job. And it makes sense, because one of the great forces of all of history that drives creativity all through history. How am I doing on time? I'm doing okay.
So
Have I gone about an hour? I'll bring it in with the next 15 minutes. One of the great forces that gone through all history is that the military drives a lot of innovation. It used to be the military drove almost all innovation. It's not really true anymore. In fact, it's consumer electronics in the military, sort of the opposite poles, driving innovation. And so the military is driving this real transhumanist wedge of innovation. And so that's something you at least need to be aware of, because it's an element of the world that we're all in now. Now this is a picture. This is not a pretty picture, but I think it's sometimes a necessary picture. There are some polarities in human experience right now, and we saw both of them on 9/11. I apologize because 9/11 is overworked, but it's a singular event, and because of that, it illuminates certain features of human nature. Really, so trust. The indoctrination that they've received over any of the messages they're receiving from their body, that, in other words, they've been so corrupted by an idea that they will cast aside the embodiment of the idea in favor of the idea itself. So that's one side of it. And then you have this long gray slope. And then you have the most powerful, far more powerful than anything else, that I saw of images of that day, which was two people leaping out of the World Trade Center holding hands. All right, this is the dipole that describes the situation that we're in, that we can either be incredibly destructive, or we can say we're all in this together, and if you go, I go. And somewhere in here is where we spend most of the rest of our time, depending on what kind of day we've been. And it's ridiculous to insist that this is where we have to end up, because it seems almost impossible to end up there. That it would require a superhuman effort. It would require turning us all into saints. That we would all have to reveal the better halves of our natures all the time. And yet, in some sense, what I see, that's what's being demanded of us. And in some sense, we need to avail ourselves of every opportunity. Some of those opportunities to achieve that, some of those opportunities are going to be far